Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 2. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 25. In this chapter, we're going to see Elijah taken to heaven in a whirlwind. Our context is this. In the first chapter of 2 Kings, we saw Elijah denouncing Ahab's son Ahaziah. Ahaziah, the two-year king who fell through the lattice window, who sent 150 men trying to kill Elijah because Elijah said, "You're going to die because you sent messengers, Ahaziah, you did. You sent messengers to inquire of Beelzebub to see whether you were going to recover from your fall through the lattice." That was the last chapter. So now we start 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. "And it came about when the Lord was about to take up Elijah by a whirlwind to heaven that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, 'Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel.' But Elisha said, 'As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you.' So they went down to Bethel." Now here we're going to see Elijah's farewell tour. He's going to go from Gilgal to Bethel to Jericho, then across the Jordan River, and he's going to be taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. Now, Elisha is going to accompany him the whole way. All the way, Elijah's going to be saying, no, Elisha, let's don't go. Just stay where you are." But Elisha stuck with Elijah all the way to the end. Now, the question of where Elijah started this farewell tour from turns on where Gilgal is. I'm looking at a map right now from BibleAtlas.org, and there are four Gilgals on that map, and every last one of them has a question mark by it. Well, let's shrink it down to three. There's one Gilgal down near Jerusalem in the Jordan Valley, right north of the northern tip of the Dead Sea. That's where Joshua crossed the Jordan River when he first entered the Promised Land with the children of Israel. Now, there's two Gilgals down there. They don't know where it is. The scholars don't, and that's why there's question marks. But we'll just call that one Gilgal. So now we've got two other Gilgals. There's one Gilgal right to the, within a mile or so, to the east of Shechem, the famous Shechem, where Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim are, the Blessings and the Curses Mountain. That's a Gilgal. And then if you go about 10 miles south of Shechem, you will hit the third possible place that Gilgal is located. That's about 8 miles north of Bethel and about 5 miles or so southwest of Shiloh, famous places in the scriptures. So the question is where did he start from? Well, the interesting thing is I found commentators that chose all three of those Gilgals. So we don't know. All right, I'm going to call Gilgal number one the one near Shechem, Gilgal number two the ones in the plains of Jericho where Joshua crossed over, and Gilgal number three the one that's 8 miles north of Bethel and about 10 miles south of Shechem and southwest of Shiloh, a couple of miles. That's Gilgal number three. Now, Gilgal number one near Shechem, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that's where Elijah started from, and so does the pulpit commentary. Gilgal number two is where Joshua first crossed the Jordan River in the plains of the Jordan. John Gill says that's where Elijah started from. Most of the commentators, however, say that Elijah and Elisha started out at Gilgal number three, which is 8 miles north of Bethel, southwest of Shiloh, and about 10 miles south of Shechem. Easton's dictionary says so. Ellicott, McLaren, Barnes, and Colin Delitzsch, the four commentators, say so. So majority rules, that's what he started from. So starting from Gilgal, verse 2, Elijah says to Elisha, "Stay here, please. The Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. I want to go 8 miles south to Bethel, and you stay here in Gilgal." Now, we need to speculate upon why was Elijah so keen on leaving Elisha behind. Apparently, God had already revealed to Elijah that Elijah was going to die, so he was trying to leave Elisha. Maybe he wanted to leave the world in private. He didn't want anybody watching him. Maybe he didn't want to bring glory to himself because he's going to be translated rather than dying in the normal way, and he knew that that would cause quite a stir. That's John Gill's idea. It could be that Elijah did not want Elisha to be consumed by grief when Elisha saw Elijah leaving this world. Adam Clark suggests that Elijah is testing Elisha's fidelity. Are you going to stay with me? Are you going to stay with me? Well, of all those speculations, I think it's easier to say that Elijah did not want to see Elisha grieving over the fact that he was dying. So he's saying, stay behind. Don't want you to see this. We're going to see, though, that Elisha and the schools of the prophet knew that Elijah was going to die. I don't know whether that means that Elijah knew that they knew, but they did know, as we'll see as we go through the story here. Now, Elijah gives Elisha a reason for him going to Bethel. He says, the Lord has sent me. And of course, there was a school of the prophets at Bethel. There was a school of prophets at Gilgal. There was a school of the prophets at Bethel. And there was a school of prophets at Jericho. And Elijah is just telling Elisha, hey, I'm going down there to see the prophets down there, just on a normal tour. He's trying to say that nothing special. I'm just leaving now, so you need to stay here. That down in verse 2, so they went down after Elijah swears an oath as the Lord lives. That's this common oath. By God, I'm not leaving you, Elijah. That shows his incredible devotion to Elijah. They went down to Bethel. That's because Gilgal's up in the air. Bethel's a little bit lower. In fact, that adverb there, down, is used by some commentators to say that the Gilgal in question is Gilgal number 3, the one that's 8 miles north of Bethel. Kylan Delitzsch does that, for example. We go now to 2 Kings 2, verses 3 through 8. Then the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? That's how we know that the sons of the prophets knew. It had been revealed to them by the Spirit. And Elisha said, yes, I know. Be still. So Elisha knew too. And then Elisha tells the rest of the prophets at Bethel, be still. Don't talk about it anymore. Elijah said to him, Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho. But he said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they came to Jericho. So we have a repeat here. Same thing happened going from Gilgal to Bethel. Same thing happens going from Bethel to Jericho. Verse 5, the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho approached Elisha and said to him, do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today? So they had gotten advance notice from the Lord too. They were prophets. And Elisha answered, yes, I know. Be still. Elisha tells them the same thing. Don't talk about it in front of Elijah. Let's just sit on it. Verse 6, then Elijah said to him, please stay here. That's in Jericho. For the Lord has sent me to the Jordan. Of course, Jericho was about 5 miles from the Jordan River. And Elisha says, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So Elisha sticks with Elijah, and the two of them went on. Verse 7, now 50 men of the sons of the prophets, these are the 50 men of prophets, 50 prophets at Jericho, they went and stood opposite Elijah and Elisha at a distance, while the two of them stood by the Jordan. Elijah took his mantle and folded it together and struck the waters, and they were divided here and there, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. So now Elijah and Elisha are on the east side of the Jordan in the valley. Now there was a school of prophets at Bethel, as I said, which was several miles north of Jerusalem, about 10 miles or so north of Jerusalem. Now Bethel's a famous place, and one of the reasons it was famous for, or rather I should say infamous for, is because that's where Jeroboam was, one of the places that Jeroboam had set up the golden calf worship of Yahweh, which is illegal, idolatrous, bad, evil. So in the midst of the evil, you got a school of the prophets. Some people have speculated perhaps Elijah established the school of prophets there for a check upon said idolatry. Now, why did Elisha keep telling the prophets, for example, the prophets at Bethel, to be still? And then when he went to Jericho, the prophets there said, hey, Elijah's leaving us. I know. Elisha responded, be still, be quiet. So he shut up the prophets both at Bethel and at Jericho. Why? John Gill speculates it's because Elisha did not want to be interrupted as he contemplated what was going to happen. John Gill also speculates perhaps Elisha did not want Elijah to know that everyone else knew, although I don't know why that would make any difference. I think the answer is Elisha knew that something very dramatic and very spiritual and very intimate and very awesome was about to happen. He didn't want people chattering about it. So finally, Elijah and Elisha end up at the Jordan River. In verse 8, Elijah strikes the Jordan River with his mantle, with his cloak. That's probably his hairy garment, the insignia of the prophet's office. He struck the Jordan River and it separated. Now before that, in verse 7, we saw that 50 men watched the two head toward the Jordan River. Why? These are the 50 prophets at Jericho. Why were they watching Elijah and Elisha so closely? Well, probably because they all wanted to see the assumption. I'm assuming that the Lord told them that Elijah was not only going to die, but that he was going to be taken up in a whirlwind Now, these 50 prophets might have known by direct revelation from God, or Elijah might have told them, as Adam Clark suggests. It says 50 men. It doesn't say where they're from, but we can assume they're from Jericho because that's the last place that Elijah and Elisha had set out from going to the Jordan River. So they're watching. Elijah strikes the Jordan River with his mantle, and the Jordan River divides. Now, this is a huge miracle to set the stage for a momentous event, and it, of course, reminds us of the dividing of the Red Sea when the Israelites crossed. The Israelites crossed in to the desert on the way to the Promised Land. Elijah's getting ready to cross on over into heaven. Reminds me of Stonewall Jackson when he was dying. He was a dedicated Christian, and he said, "Let us cross on over the Jordan and rest in the shade of the trees." When he was delirious, but I'm sure he was having a near-death experience as he was dying at Gurney Station. We go down to 2 Kings 2, verses 9 through 10. When they had crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you." Now, Elijah has a lot of confidence here in his ability to petition God. He's saying, "Whatever you want, Elisha, I'll give it to you. I'll do for you." Well, he was a prophet. He was an extraordinary prophet. It's not surprising he had such confidence. So Elijah said to Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you." And Elisha said, "Please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me." He said, "You have asked a hard thing." That's Elijah said that. "You have asked a hard thing, Elisha. Nevertheless, if you, Elijah, see me, when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you." In other words, you'll get a double portion. "But if not, it shall not be so." You won't get a double portion. So in verse 9, Elijah has quit being coy about the fact he's about to be taken to heaven. He said, "Before I am taken from you," he says the words out loud. Elijah had already had a full trial of Elisha's loyalty and affection. He watched Elisha following him all the way into the wilderness there. So he knows that Elisha's going to be a good successor prophet to him. Now, Elisha asked for a double portion. Now, we hear this all the time. "I want a double portion of God's anointing." You hear people talk about it all the time. But I don't think people think about exactly what it was that Elisha was asking for. I'm going to give you four options. Option number one, Elisha is referring to a portion of prophecy and a portion of miracles. In other words, a double portion means I want a two-phased inheritance from you, Elijah. I want to be able to prophesy like you can prophesy, and I want to be able to do miracles like you can do miracles. Poole agrees with this, the commentator. Poole says this, quote, "Elijah seems to have had a greater portion of the prophetical and miraculous gifts of God's Spirit than Elijah had." Now, that is a very, very, very minority opinion that Poole just gave. Adam Clark says that the double portion refers to the two-phase aspect of Elijah's ministry, prophecy and miracles, and double portion means, quote-unquote, two parts of your ministry, not, quote-unquote, double the quantity of your ministry. So Clark says that Elijah is not doing greater prophecies and miracles. Elisha will not do greater prophecy and miracles than Elijah did. Okay, so that's option one. Double portion means one portion for prophecy, one portion for miracles. Option number two, the double portion means double the amount of prophetic power. Now, Elijah's answer to the question in verse 10 seems to back that up. Because Elijah says, "Elisha, you have asked a hard thing." Having twice the prophetic power of Elijah is a hard thing. So that might be what Elisha is asking for. Option number two. Here's some objections to the idea that Elisha is asking for double the amount of Elijah's prophetic power. Objection number one. Elisha's modesty would prevent him from asking so much, perhaps. Objection number two. As a matter of fact, Elisha did not receive twice as much prophetical power. Pulpit commentator says this. This is in contrast to Poole, who said that Elisha had received a double amount of prophetic power. Pulpit says, no, he did not. Kyle backs him up. Here's Kyle's quote. That's Kyle and Delitch. Kyle, quote, "It is only a quite external and superficial view of the career of Elisha that can see in it a proof that double the spirit of Elijah rested upon him," which is a long-winded way of saying, no, Elisha didn't have twice the miracles of Elijah. Pulpit commentator is more direct, and they say, quote, "Elisha is a very faint and feeble replica of Elijah." So, factually, as a matter of fact, you can't prove that Elisha had twice as much power as Elijah did. So option number two as to what double portion means, double the amount of prophetic power, that's going to be a hard one to defend. Option number three. Well, here's another objection to that option. A dying man cannot leave to his heir more than he has himself, as Kyle and Delitz say. So Elisha can't get a double portion. If Elijah can only do X number of miracles and prophecy, then how can he pass on to Elisha the ability to do more than X number of miracles or X power of prophecy? Not likely. So that's not a good option, option number two. And that's the option that most people think. I want a double portion of means I want a double amount of your power. But that's not, that. As I've shown, that there's a lot of objections to that. Now here, I think is the answer, option number three. Elisha is asking for a double portion of power compared to the other prophets in the schools of prophets. Now, the pulpit commentary and Adam Clark say that, and I think that's right. That's what he's asking for. I just want more than all the other prophets. Here's option number four. Elisha is referring to the double portion of the firstborn's inheritance. Remember, a firstborn got a double portion. That's the way they did it, primogeniture. If you have three kids, the father divides the estate into four. The first kid gets 2/4, the second kid gets 1/4, and the third kid gets the 4/4 for a total of 1. That's the double portion. And so what Elijah is saying here, according to this theory, is that Elisha is to be considered as the firstborn of Elijah. That double portion is actually written into the law, Deuteronomy 21:17, but he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the hated, by giving him a double portion of all that he hath. For he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. This is referring to when a man has two wives and polygamy. I'm not going to worry about that. The point is the double portion is in the law. But the problem with that is Elijah said that to give you a double portion would be a hard thing. What's so hard about asking for an inheritance? Nothing hard about that. I mean, it was done all the time. So I think the answer is Elisha is asking for twice the power and a prophetic ability of the other prophets in the schools of the prophets. Well, whatever the double portion was, Elisha did not want the double portion for his personal glory. He wanted it for God's purposes. I think we can count on that. Now in verse 10, Elijah says, if you see me, you got it. If you see me, you've got the double portion. If you see me when I am taken from you, you have the double portion. Now that's a little bit strange. Here's an option as to what is meant here. Elijah could mean that seeing Elijah being taken up would be a token that Elisha would have a double portion. In other words, it's such a privilege to see me taken up into heaven. If you see it, well, that means God's going to give you a double portion of my power. And of course, this would have needed to be previously revealed to Elijah by God so he could pass the word on to Elisha. Another option is that what Elijah is saying here, he's saying, Elisha, if you see me until the end, you will be with me to the end. So that means if you are with me to the end, then you're faithful and loyal, and by golly, you're going to get a double portion. Adam Clark takes it this way, and he says this, quote, perhaps this means no more than, quote, if thou continue with me till I am translated, God will grant this to thee, for on the mere seeing, unquote. For on the mere seeing or not seeing him in the moment in which he was taken away, this divine gift could not depend. Clark's got a point. It seems sort of strange. Just because you see Elijah taken up in the whirlwind, why would that be a sign that the double portion was going to be given to Elisha? I don't know. So I think what he's saying is if you're with me all the way to the end, that means you're faithful, you're obedient, and you're going to get the double portion, Elisha. We go now to 2 Kings 2, verses 11 through 12. As they were going along and talking, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire, which separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind to heaven. Elisha saw it and cried out, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw Elijah no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. Now, the chariot of fire separated Elijah and Elisha. That's by driving between the two prophets, as Kyle and Delitzsch say. Before this happened, they were deep in talk. What could they have been talking about? Well, the double portion that Elisha had requested, the state of religion in Israel, which I'm sure was not very good, the training up of the prophets in the colleges to keep the word of Yahweh alive in the midst of all the paganism and all the idolatry in the schools of the prophets in Bethel, Gilgal, and Jericho. They could have been talking about Elisha's succession as a prophet, his future ministry as Elijah dies. Or actually, he didn't die. He was taken up to heaven. Now, Elisha saw a chariot of fire and horses of fire. And, of course, the curious reader will ask, what in the world was that? Well, I'm going to give you two options. One option is angels, and the other options are clouds that look like chariots of fire and horses of fire. Let's look at the angel option first. This is from John Gill. Quote, angels in this form, in which they appeared for the glory and honor of the prophet, and as emblems of his flaming love and zeal for the purity of religion, and that his assumption might be conspicuous to Elisha, and perhaps by this means might be seen by the 50 men on the other side of the Jordan. This chariot, drawn with these horses, was not seen in the heaven, but as running on the earth, and came between the two prophets, and separated them from each other, taking up Elijah into it by means of a wind whirling about him, and which was no other than the ministry of angels. I think that's the normal way of interpreting that. But the other option as to what the chariot of fire and horses of fire was or were is clouds. Let me read John Gill. Quote, a conflux of exhalations or clouds formed in this likeness, the likeness of a chariot of fire and a horse of fire, formed in this likeness by supernatural power and by the solar rays striking on them might appear fiery or red. And so his assumption was much in such like manner as our Lord was taken up in a cloud. In other words, the Shekinah glory of God came down on Elijah, which is, of course, the cloud that we see all the time in the Old Testament. Jesus, of course, was taken up in a cloud from the Mount of Olives when he ascended. And so Gill says Elijah is taken up exactly the same way. Now, if you like patterns through the Bible, that is sort of a pattern. And so that makes that option a little bit attractive. Colin Dillich says that the chariot of fire and horses of fire were this, quote, the storm was accompanied by a fiery phenomenon which appeared to the eyes of Elisha as a chariot of fire with horses of fire, in which Elijah rode to heaven. The tempest was an earthly substratum for the theophany, the fiery chariots and fiery horses, the symbolical form in which the translation of his master to heaven presented itself to the eye of Elisha, who was left behind. Well, Colin Dillich doesn't say that the chariot and horses were clouds, but he says they're earthly phenomena. I don't know what they would be if they weren't clouds. Commentator Benson, the Methodist, 19th century Methodist commentator, says this, the chariot of fire and horses of fire were, quote, a bright, resplendent cloud, perhaps thrown into the form of a chariot and horses by the angels who came in it. Well, he kind of splits the difference, says it's both clouds and angels. Basically, nobody knows exactly what happened. This is a mysterious thing. It's always been mysterious to me. But since Jesus took the Old Testament, every jot and tittle of it, to be inspired, we can, if we believe in the Scriptures, rest assured that this is what happened. And this is not an ordinary occurrence. Most people don't die this way. Elijah was very close to God. This was an unusual event. And by the way, it was not a subjective vision because Elisha saw it. And Elijah left. Elijah can't leave in a vision that's inside of Elisha's head. When Elijah left, Elisha took hold of his clothes and tore them in two pieces. That's the typical standard way to express your grief. Who was he grieving for? Well, for himself. He missed Elijah. He could have been grieving for the public which public was going to lose the services of Elijah as a prophet. He wasn't grieving for Elijah, though, because Elijah was in the presence of his Lord. We go now to 2 Kings 2, verses 13 through 15. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and returned and stood by the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and struck the waters and said, where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? And when he also had struck the waters, they were divided here and there, and Elisha crossed over. Now when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho opposite him saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. And they came to meet him and bowed themselves to the ground before him. Now, these 50 prophets of Jericho, probably from Jericho, they saw Elijah and Elisha cross the Jordan. That does not mean they saw Elijah taken up in the chariot of fire, so we're not really sure that they saw what they saw, but they did see Elisha coming back. Verse 13, Elisha takes the mantle of Elijah, stood by the bank of the Jordan, that's the eastern bank. Remember, he's crossed over the Jordan already when Elijah struck the Jordan with Elijah's mantle, that same mantle, and so Elisha picks up the mantle, comes back, and strikes the water again so he can cross. Now, why did Elisha pick up Elijah's mantle to do that? Well, Elisha torn his in two, and he needed one. That's a practical reason. Also, Elijah's mantle was probably a symbol of his new office. So when he comes back with Elijah's mantle, all the prophets in the school of the prophets of Jericho can say, oh, we got a new leader of the school of the prophets. Another reason might be that Elisha considered that there was power in that mantle. Elijah had used the mantle to split the Jordan River before, and Elisha might think, well, God used it once. Maybe he'll use it again to split the Jordan River. In verse 14, Elisha himself struck the waters and said, where's the Lord, the God of Elijah? That's a strange thing to say. What he's asking is, are you there, Lord, so you can split this river again so I can get back? He's calling for God to work the miracle. Where's the Lord, the God of Elijah? Are you there, Lord? Now, that miracle confirmed Elisha in the eyes of the other prophets of Jericho. We can read in verse 15, and when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho opposite him saw him, they said, the spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha. So Elisha is confirmed. He's the new CEO of the school of the prophets, the new principal, if you will. They came and showed their subservience to Elisha, their respect and honor of him, by bowing down to the ground before him. Verses 16 through 18 of 2 Kings 2 comes next. Then the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, since there are 50 strong men here with your servants, please let them go and search for your master. Maybe the spirit of the Lord has carried him away and put him on one of the mountains or into one of the valleys. Elisha answered, don't send them. However, the prophets of Jericho, however many they were, they urged Elisha to the point of embarrassment to go look for Elijah. So Elisha said, send them. Send the 50 strong men. The prophets sent 50 men who looked for 3 days but did not find Elijah. When the 50 strong men returned to Elisha in Jericho where Elisha was staying, Elisha said to them, didn't I tell you not to go? Of course, it was pointless to go because Elisha knew that he'd been taken up in heaven. And by the way, that tells me that the Jericho prophets probably did not see the chariot of fire coming to take Elijah home, swinging. They didn't see that chariot swinging low to take Elijah home. And that's why they sent 50 strong men out to look for Elijah. They better thought, well, he got lost over there. Maybe he got sick or something. We need to go find him. Now, this seems strange. All they got to do is ask Elisha and say, look, we need to find Elijah. Then Elisha says, I was just with him. He was taken up to heaven in a chariot of fire. Seems like that would have been good enough. No, they got to go see for themselves. Maybe they thought that chariot of fire took him to a mountain somewhere, or just maybe Elisha had a hallucination in the desert from the heat. Who knows? I don't know why they didn't believe him. But they sent out 50 men who looked for 3 days to look for Elijah before they were finally convinced that Elijah is bye-bye. He's gone. And so when they come back, Elisha in verse 18 does a little bit of I told you so. Didn't I tell you not to go? Let's look at this question again of why they did the prophets of Jericho want to search for Elijah since they already knew Elijah was to be taken away, as we said earlier. But as Gil says, they didn't know for how long he was to be taken away. They thought he might be found again. They might have thought God had taken him to heaven, but then he's going to bring him back. And as I said earlier, they probably had not actually seen the ascension of Elijah, so they thought that perhaps the whirlwind took Elijah and put him into a valley somewhere on a mountain. In other words, they might have believed Elisha. Oh, yeah, Elisha, we believe you. There was a chariot of fire. There was a whirlwind. But how do you know that that whirlwind took him all the way up into heaven? Maybe the whirlwind took him somewhere else, like on another mountain. We're going to go look for him. Now, they kept pressing Elisha to go look for Elijah, it says, to the point of embarrassment. Why would it be embarrassing for Elisha to continue to object to the search? Well, if Elisha continues to object, that looks like he's not respecting Elijah. What's the matter, Elisha? You don't care about what happened to your master, Elijah? Or maybe it looks like Elisha is trying to protect his newfound office. What's the matter, Elisha? Are you scared if we find Elijah and he comes back, you're not going to be the CEO of the school of the prophets anymore? Whatever the reason was, Elisha finally relented and said, okay, you go look for him. If you're going to waste your time doing that, fine. We go now to 2 Kings 2, verses 19 through 22. Then the men of the city said to Elisha, that city, of course, is Jericho, behold now, the situation of this city, Jericho, is pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the land is unfruitful. He said, bring me a new jar and put salt in it. So they brought it to him. He went out to the spring of water and threw salt in it and said, thus says the Lord, I have purified these waters. There shall not be from there death or unfruitfulness any longer. So the waters have been purified to this day according to the word of Elisha which he spoke. So this is Elisha's first miracle. Now, Jericho was pleasant, it says. Let me read you some couple of good quotes from commentaries about how pleasant Jericho was. John Gill, first quote, Jericho was, quote, in a plain surrounded with gardens and orchards, with vineyards, olive yards, and groves of palm trees and other odoriferous ones. Got even a better quote from the pulpit commentary. Jericho was, quote, lying on a broad plain which is traversed by an abundant river, at the point where one of the main wadis debouched from the Judean upland upon the low country, shaded by groves of palm trees and fig mulberries, the air scented with aromatic shrubs, opal balsam, myrobalanum, whatever that is, and the like, facing the orient sun and commanding a wide prospect, both across and also up and down the gore. I'll tell you what the gore is in a minute. With the mountains of Moab in the distance, Jericho was no doubt, even before the miracle of Elisha, a pleasant place. But there was one drawback. The water is naught and the ground barren. We'll talk about the water in just a minute. The gore. What is the gore? Jericho is near the gore. That's G-H-O-R. Here's encyclopedia.com. The gore is, quote, a region of the Jordan Valley, 70 miles long between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, on the border of Jordan and Israel in the West Bank. The gore is entirely below sea level and bordered by steep escarpments. Escarpments are a rocky cliff. It is part of the Great Rift Valley complex, the Arba Valley. The Jordan River meanders 160 feet below the surface through the gore. I guess what that means is the Jordan River actually goes underground there for a while. I haven't actually seen this, so I don't know exactly what it looks like, but it does sound like Jericho is a very pleasant place. It's in the present-day Palestinian-occupied territories over there in Israel, and so my tour could not get there. I sure would have liked to have seen Jericho. But anyway, so the question arises, how can the city be so pleasant if the water is so bad and the land is unfruitful? Well, John Gill says that this is one way you can explain that. The bad refers to a part, but not the whole of Jericho, where the prophets were not staying. In other words, the water is good in general, and the crops grow, and the trees grow, and everything's fine. But in one place where Elisha was staying, the water was bad. I don't believe that. That just seems a little far-fetched to me. My opinion, what it is this. Crops can live on brackish water. Animals and humans cannot. I mean, crops, you can put sewage on crops, and the crops will grow. But animals and humans can't drink sewage. All right, so this bad water, let's talk about that. In verse 19, it says, the water is bad and the land is unfruitful. Barnes says you can translate that unfruitful this way, quote, and the land apt to miscarry. Here's Barnes' further commentary on that, quote, the stream was thought to be the cause of untimely births, abortions, and the like among the cattle, perhaps also among the people that drank of it. The pulpit commentator says this about the water, bitter and brackish springs, of which there are many in the Jordan Valley, gushed forth from the foot of the mountains and formed rivulets, which ran across the plain towards the Jordan, not diffusing health and fertility, but rather disease and barrenness. Untimely births, abortions, and the like prevailed among the cattle which were fed in the neighborhood, perhaps even among the inhabitants of the locality, and were attributed to the bitter springs, which made the land miscarrying. A technoumene, which is what the Septuagint has as its translation of the word there, the Hebrew word for unfruitful. So the land miscarried. Well, that makes sense. You got a beautiful land, but you got bad water. That can be reconciled. Again, because in my opinion, the way you reconcile it is crops can grow. I mean, in fact, in Israel now, if you go to the part of Israel where the desert has been reclaimed from the wilderness and you got all these beautiful crops growing, it used to be nothing but sand, and you look at all these little blue pumps along the way. I asked my tour guide, what are those blue pumps? He said, they're pumping sewage into the sand, and that's what's making the crops grow. Sewage. Well, see, you can have bad water that makes crops grow and trees grow, but animals and humans, they need clear water. So, Elisha healed the water. He said, bring me a new jar and put salt in it. He said, a new jar. He said that so that no one could think that something previous in the jar could have freshened the water that he was about to sweeten up. Salt is a good object to put in the water because salt stands for preservation. Salt will preserve meat, and so he put salt in the waters to preserve the waters from their corruption. So the Lord said, I have purified these waters. They shall not be from their death or unfruitfulness any longer. A perfect symbol, if you will, of the life-giving ministry of a prophet of God. The waters have been purified to this day. That would be the days of Jeremiah, probably, who wrote this book, according to the word of Elisha. We go now to 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 23 through 25, and we will finish this audio. Then Elisha went up from there to Bethel, went from Jericho back to Bethel. He's retracing his steps. And as he was going up by the way, young lads came out from the city. These are the Bethel boys. They mocked him and said to him, go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head. When Elisha looked behind him and saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Then two female bears came out of the woods and tore up 42 lads of their number. Elisha went from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to Samaria. Now, what does that go up mean? Go up, you bald head. Well, if they're behind Elisha, they could be saying go on up to Bethel, because Bethel's up in a hill. It could be that these boys were jeering Elisha and saying, go on up into heaven just like Elijah did. Get out of here. We don't want you here. One commentator speculates that their malignant spirit probably came from their God-hating parents. I wouldn't doubt that in the least. That phrase, go up, you bald head, has always been kind of problematic to me. Why would the boys be saying to Elisha, go on up to Bethel? What's the big deal about that? I think what they're doing is mocking him about going up into heaven. They probably heard the word by now what had happened to Elijah. Why was Elisha going to Bethel from Jericho? Yeah, well, it could be he was going there to tell the prophets at Bethel what had happened to Elijah, and also to console the prophets of Bethel for the fact that Elijah had left them. Well, maybe the prophets of Bethel already knew the boys, apparently, that were mocking the ascension by saying, go up, they knew. So probably the prophets in Bethel knew, too, already what had happened to Elijah. But Elisha could have been going there just to tell them the details. After all, he saw it firsthand. Tell them the details and also to comfort them, saying, don't worry about it. And also, he's the new head of the schools of the prophets. So he's going around doing his tour so that people would respect him and understand his authority and leadership. Now these lads, as the NESB translates it, little children as the King James translates it erroneously, these lads had 42 of their number eaten up by two female bears, after Elijah cursed them when they mocked him. Now this has led to some dispute about, was this proper or not for Elisha to do this? I don't have any problem with it. But first of all, before we decide on whether it's all right to curse little children, this is the way it's phrased. Oh, they were just little kids having a little bit of fun, and the prophet killed 42 of them. How is that fair? Well, first of all, the translation little children of the KJV is quite misleading. Now, Adam Clark says the word translated there is used of persons 30 or 40 years of age. Clark says this, the word can refer to this, quote, a young man or servant or even a soldier or one fit to go out to battle, and is so translated in a multitude of places in our common English version, the KJV. Clark gives an example of that, 1 Kings 20, verse 14. Ahab said, by whom, who's going to win this battle? So the prophet, the unnamed prophet, says, by the young men of the rulers of the provinces, the young men, not the children. And these people are going to be fighting a battle. Little kids don't fight battles. So Clark makes a good point there. Also, you see that these kids were old enough to be able to leave the city by themselves without adult supervision. So they're not little kids. This is the way typically critics of this will put it, quote, but was it not a cruel thing to destroy 42 little children who in mere childishness had simply called the prophet bald head? Well, there's your two extremes. Clark says they're 30 or 40 years old. The KJV says they're little kids, little children. Here's what the pulpit commentary says. They say they were between 12 and 15. Little children is an unfortunate translation, raising quite a wrong idea of the tender age of the person spoken of. On the other hand, Bishop Patrick's assertion that the words are to be understood of adult persons who had a hatred to the prophet is quite untenable. Well, so not everybody agrees with Clark, obviously. Pulpit says it's not little kids, it's not adult men, it's teenagers, basically between 12 and 15, adolescents. All right, so now having set the stage, can we say that it was cruel of the prophet to call down curses on the heads of these kids? Before we consider that question, let's see how other translations translate the Hebrew word here. The Holman Christian Study Bible and the New American Bible say they were, quote-unquote, small boys. The American Standard Version says they were young lads. The Young's Literal Translation says they were little youths. The Bible in Basic English says they were little boys. God's Word Translation says they were boys. So the translations have them somewhat on the young side. Well, however old they were, we'll take them at least not any older than 15, just to make the case harder against Elisha for cursing them. The younger they are, the more sympathy we have for the kids. In verse 24, Elisha looked behind, which means he was being followed by these juvenile delinquents, and he probably looked at them very sternly. He probably rebuked them with his countenance, but they refused to back off. They kept right on coming. So, again, that's a speculation, but it's reasonable. So Elisha curses the kids. Did he do it by personal revenge or anger? Or was he moved by the Spirit of God? I suggest the latter. He was moved by the Spirit of God. Elisha had a very, very high concept of the honor and holiness of God, and these kids, these juvenile delinquents, are mocking God. When they mock the prophet of God, they're mocking Yahweh himself. And in fact, when they say, "Go up, you bald head," that doesn't sound so bad, baldy in our language, but bald head, as one of my commentators says, was, quote, an epithet of contempt in the East applied to a person even with a bushy head of hair. So in their culture, to call somebody bald was extremely derogatory. Now, going back to the issue, was Elisha justified in cursing those kids? Well, it's a terrible thing to mock the miracles of God if they were mocking the ascension of Elijah. The Pharisees mocked the miracles of God, and Jesus said they were blaspheming against the Holy Spirit. Notice that God did not kill the kids directly. The bears did the killing. Elisha did not kill the kids directly. Elijah only cursed the kids. God made the bears do it. Elijah had no control over the bears, so we can say, well, see there, Elisha had no control over the bears, so we can say, well, Elisha's not at fault. Well, okay, well, then you just move the problem back from Elisha to Yahweh, because he did make the bears come after the kids, because no miracle would have been done had not God done it, unless you want to say this is a purely natural event. It just coincidentally happened right after the curse came, but I don't believe that for a minute. I believe the curse had something directly to do with God killing those 42 kids. Now, Adam Clark says that Elisha's curse of the young boys was only declaratory, with his emphasis, Clark's emphasis. Elisha's curse was only declaratory of what God was about to do. Well, again, if that gets Elisha off the moral hook merely because he's proclaiming what God's about to do, well, what about God? How do we get him off the hook, the ethical hook? You know, Adam Clark, who comes up with all this stuff about declaratory rather than imprecatory and all, he's an Arminian. He's constantly apologizing when God judges. I've been reading Clark for 20, 30 years, and I don't know how long. I've gone from the first verse in Genesis to the last verse in Revelation, and Adam Clark, along with two other commentators, has been my guide all the way through. So I'm very familiar with Adam Clark, and I know he's an Arminian, and I know whenever there's any kind of judgment, well, you know, we don't want people to think that God's not fair. It is perfectly fair to God to do that. These people will mock it. You don't mock God. You just don't. And it doesn't matter how young you are or how old you are. You just don't mock God. You're subject to getting fried. Now, these two bears that came and got the 42 youths, they were female, and female bears are the most ferocious, especially when they're bereaved of their baby bears. Woo. Now, Clark, again, trying to make it look fair for God to do what he did, Clark says it's possible that the young men were destroying the baby cubs of the female bears. And so what happened to the 42 deceased youths perhaps had a natural component to it. Well, that's speculation, speculation, speculation. Who knows? The point is they mocked God and they paid for it. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say of this act of the bears tearing up the 42 youths, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this, quote, "The appalling judgment that befell them, the youths, was God's interference to uphold the newly invested prophet." In other words, not only do you not mess with Yahweh, you don't mess with Elisha either. Now, God had to give power to these prophets. They were living in the midst of the most appalling, idolatrous circumstances. The political power was against them. The official religion was golden calf worship. They needed authority from Yahweh. And this kind of incident, people are going to pretty soon say, ooh, maybe we better not mess with Elisha and the school of the prophets. So Elisha leaves from Bethel after the 42 youths are killed. He goes from Bethel to Mount Carmel in verse 25. That's at the extreme northwest of the city. Present-day Haifa is there at the head of the Jezreel Valley. Elijah, of course, used to frequent that area. That's where he won the contest with the prophets of Baal during Ahab's time. Gill speculates there might have been a school of prophets there. I wouldn't doubt it because I think that what Elisha is doing, he's on a progress. He is going from school to school to school to establish his authority. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with 1 Kings chapter 2. We are now ready to go in our next audio to 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 through 27. Moab rebels against Israel. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.